and Now, and today we bring you a special Thanksgiving edition of Here and Now. As families or friends gather on this day, a toast is often raised to the one who's missing from the table. Well, today ours is to William Styron, the iconic American author who died on November 1st at the age of 81. He leaves a legacy of passionate and controversial novels, from his Pulitzer Prize-winning The Confessions of Nat Turner, about the bloody slave uprising that led up to the Civil War, to Sophie's Choice, the excruciating story of the Polish Holocaust survivor forced by Nazis to choose which of her two children will survive the camps, which will die. Well, here to reflect on the life and legacy of William Styron, his wife of 53 years, Rose Styron, in her own right a poet, a human rights activist, and a friend to and supporter of a circle of powerful, successful men who shared with her husband their own battles with depression. So she also has insight into a disease that many families are dealing with this time of year. And Rose Styron joins us from a studio near her home on Martha's Vineyard. First of all, Rose, our condolences.
Thank you, Robin.
And I'm wondering, has it helped that so many, since November 1st, have tried to convey what his loss means? I'm looking, Kurt Vonnegut said, your husband was dramatic, he was fun, he was strong and proud, awfully good with the language. The accolades, you know, immediately began flowing. Has that helped?
Oh, it's helped enormously. I'm still getting dozens a day, whether they're printed tributes or broadcasts or letters. They talk about his generosity, his gentleness, his humanity, his love of the world and all the people in it who are suffering or who are joyous, as he was by turn.
Well, this time of year, a lot of families wrestle with the suffering, depression. Was your husband's depression seasonal? You know, it's darker outside, the leaves have fallen, it's gray on Martha's Vineyard. Was this time harder for him?
He hated the coming of fall. He hated not fall itself, but the anticipation of cold and of winter. And Thanksgiving was sort of his last moment of pleasure, being with his family around the dinner table, and recently having all his children and his grandchildren around for Thanksgivings. And after that, he hated Christmas, he hated January and February in the cold, and he hated the shortening, darkening of the days, yeah, as you suggested.
Well, you know, I want to talk more about that, but we want to remind ourselves of the bibliography, and then maybe, you know, how much was the incredible writing because of the depression a side effect, or did it perhaps help cause it? But just to remind ourselves, you know, the first big work, Lie Down in Darkness, about a young Southern girl's suicide, that was in 1951. Then we skipped to 67, when Bill won the Pulitzer Prize for The Confessions of Nat Turner. That, of course, is told from the point of view of the historical figure who led the failed slave insurrection before the Civil War. That book, you know, first acclaimed and then sparked an outcry from black writers who said, you know, a white man couldn't write the black man's experience. There was a book of essays in 1968 called William Styron's Nat Turner, 10 Black Writers Respond. He talked about their criticism at a Library of Congress event in 1998. Let's just listen.
I was especially lacerated and hurt over the fact that the book was labeled racist. And that was a very hard thing to take for a writer who had attempted really to write a book whose heart was an exposure of the horrors and evils of slavery.
How tough was that for him when that criticism came?
Oh, it was tremendously tough. And in a funny way, he was scared for us, for his family. He thought maybe something would happen to us, and he was always looking outside and always wondering where we were. And I have the feeling that that sparked something very deep inward that may have led to a depression, even though the depression itself was like 18 years later.
Yeah, the full outbreak. We should say that at that time, Bill was very close to the influential African-American writer James Baldwin. They were almost male soulmates. And James Baldwin stood by your husband's side.
It was very comforting and healing to Bill to have Jimmy stand by him, as the great historian John Hope Franklin did when so many others were attacking him.
Well, his next novel would come more than a decade later. Sophie's Choice was made into an Oscar-nominated film starring Meryl Streep. It tells the story of the aspiring writer Stingo, who meets Sophie, a Polish refugee, and her lover Nathan in a Brooklyn boarding house. You have a reading from Sophie's Choice where Stingo finds Sophie and Nathan after they've both committed suicide. And Stingo throws his journal into the fire and watches his words slowly burn.
These words at a certain level have the quality of a strapping homily. Nonetheless, they are remarkably beautiful, strung together in their honest, lump-like English syllables. And as I see them now on the ledger's page, the page itself the hue of a dried daffodil and oxidized slowly by time into near transparency. My eyes are arrested by the furious underlining, scratch, 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 lacerations, as if the suffering Stingo, whom I once inhabited, or who once inhabited me, learning it firsthand and for the first time in his grown-up life about death and pain and loss and the appalling enigma of human existence, was trying physically to excavate from that paper the only remaining, perhaps the only bearable truth. Let your love flow out on all living things.
As you read that, you know, he was an author and he was writing a novel, but William Styron has also said that that was him speaking. What is he saying? What do you think he's saying there, Rose?
Well, I think for the first time he really understood human pain. And he also understood that letting your love flow was the only way to fight what was obviously incipient depression and have joy in life.
And there's that, but then there's also this book, Sophie's Choice, with this exquisitely unbearable ending. This woman whose story is, you almost can't read it, you almost couldn't see it on the screen. It's just, even now my heart, you know, at her choice. How did he live with that, writing that?
That's a very good question, Robin, because in the first version, when he started the book, and it took him 7 years to write it, and we lived through 7 years of Sophie and Vonda and Nathan and Stingo, who were much more real to him often than we, his family. We would have to get into the book and the book's, you know, characters with him in order to have any kind of human realistic dialogue. In the beginning, he started the book with the scene of Sophie's choice at Auschwitz, choosing which child has to die, and I freaked out. I said, you just can't start it there. You have to let that come somewhere near the end or at the end after you've created the rest of the story. I instinctively did not feel that I could bear living all the years he wrote it, knowing that this is how it started. I was afraid readers, you know, wouldn't be able to go on. That's one of the very few times I had any real input into his writing.
And I'm thinking that his writing about that choice, not averting his eyes from what really happened at Auschwitz, especially given that he had depression, was a brave thing to do.
He was. He was a very brave man. And I don't know how he wrote himself through that.
Well, and then, you know, one wonders, it brings us to the chicken and the egg. Did he pay for it? I mean, do you think that the stories like that, or the suicide of the young girl and Lie Down in Darkness, did they unhinge the depression? Or was the depression always there and the depression was the friend that actually was able to take him to these dark stories?
I think the second. I think that's a very good way to put it, Robin. I think the books and the stories of the characters he invented who were always himself or harboring his darkest thoughts allowed him to write and to live.
When you say how ill he was, Kurt Vonnegut said he hated to see him end this way. Gore Vidal said he had a bad ending. Could you explain to people how bad depression gets? It's not just a bad day.
Oh, no. It's such a long, painful, tunnel to be in, and you never believe you can get out of it. And when you do get out of it, you rejoice, but you know you could go right back into it again, and nobody understands. It's such a lonely place. It was physically incredibly crippling, as if the brain had ceased to direct the body in any way or to motivate the body or the spirit. And, of course, it was dreadful in his brain. He, at some point, had the cruelest delusions about himself, feeling that he had been condemned by God to limbo below Dante's imagining, limbo forever. Mm. He believed off and on that aliens had stolen his brain. Paul Theroux reminded me in a letter yesterday of a conversation they'd had where Bill was convinced that the Nazis had brought their gas machine on the ferry to Martha's Vineyard and were gassing him at the moment. He imagined that he was chained to a cold air conditioning machine, even though it was in Nicaragua and hot and was being persecuted that way. There were cruel, cruel psychotic moments, which he described in such beautiful narrative that you thought he was writing a novel. It was awful for him inside. But the last year or two, there was none of that. There was no clinical depression. There was sadness and disbelief at the extraordinary physical debilitation, and his feeling of helplessness was acute, so he really didn't want, you know, to face the world every day. And I think it was only for us and for his family and friends that he came downstairs every afternoon.
We are speaking with Rose Styron about her husband, the author William Styron, who died this month after that battle with depression. When we come back, what gave them both joy. But as we take a break, here's William Styron speaking in a documentary about that unbearable choice his character Sophie was forced to make.
It seemed to me that such a metaphor was far more terrible than all of the butcheries and the horrors, the beatings, the tortures, the medical experiments that the Nazis dreamed up, this one single event.
It's Here and Now, and we're back with Rose Styron, wife of the late author William Styron, who died earlier this month. The couple split their time between a farmhouse in Connecticut and a home on Martha's Vineyard, where she is now. And Rose, we talked about how the encroaching darkness and cold of Martha's Vineyard could trigger your husband's depression this time of year, but there was also such joy there.
Oh, he thought it was the most beautiful place in the world, and he loved being on his porch looking at the boats going by and the children next door. He loved taking long walks in the woods and on the beaches of the vineyard. He loved especially walking with his dogs and looking, you know, at the sky and the sea and the changing light. He was really very, very happy here.
Norman Mailer said, "No other American writer of my generation has had so omnipresent and exquisite a sense of the elegiac," which in itself is a nice elegy.
It is.
Is there a way for you to convey what his loss means to the literary world?
That would be hard for me to say. I hoped and hoped these past 3 or 4 years when he was sick that he would finish the novel that he was working on. So I think that that novel, uncompleted, is a loss to the literary world.
Mm. What was it about? Can you say?
It was to be called The Way of the Warrior, and it was about himself as a young man returning from the Pacific and starting his life again.
Is there any way you'd ever have someone else try to finish it, or does it freeze in time?
Yep. No, because he kept changing his mind about where he would start and end and how he would put it together. There are many pieces of it. His wonderful editor, Bob Loomis, at Random House might be able to make something of it. I wouldn't know how to.
Hmm. Well, I want to go back to your husband's 1990 autobiographical work, Darkness Visible, a memoir of madness. He writes about his depression. He called Darkness Visible the Rosetta Stone to his other works. In other words, it helped him interpret the other works?
We thought of that when he was writing it. We talked about that a lot, how we both suddenly realized that all his other protagonists had a very dark side. That was obviously him.
What was that like to live with this man, so successful, as you said, four beautiful children, a glorious life? You would not know this, but I remember seeing you once in the company of Diane Sawyer, and I think Leontine Price was there that night at dinner, and Carly Simon, and then there was Mike Wallace, Art Buchwald, his dear friends who also suffered from depression. You know, this incredible circle of friends, this glittering life, and you. A loving, wonderful partner. Did you ever find yourself thinking, why aren't I enough? Why can't we be enough to get you out of this?
I certainly thought that the last 5 years and wished that there was something more that we could do. And I guess my role was that of cheerleader and convener of friends who would talk to him at that point. Whether we were, you know, remembering all our glorious trips together with writer friends, you know, Carlos Fuentes in Mexico, Arthur Miller, our trips to Egypt and Chile, Peter Matheson and George Plimpton to Africa and India, James Jones, year after year in Paris, Gabriel Garcia Marquez in Cuba. And in the last two summers when he was having such a struggle, they all came to talk to him, and he responded and loved being with them. And when he couldn't write these last couple of years, the conversations with the guys, as he called them all, and Sheldon Hackney would come over every day, or the gals who were closest to him, Mia Farrow in Connecticut, and Meryl Streep and Tess Bramhall and Lucy Hackney and Betty de Robillard and Claire White, all of these people who he loved. And
yeah, but what you're doing, I don't know if you're aware of what you're doing, is bringing a lot of comfort to families with depression, I'm guessing, because they're listening to this and they're saying depression cannot be switched off by having marvelous friends.
That's right. Yes, I hope that friendship and affection from family, affection that came and attention that came through letters would keep him alive forever. He loved the mail, and he answered every letter he could from anybody over the years and fretted that he couldn't the last couple of years because mail meant so much to him, just that kind of communication. And I thought that if he kept writing or I kept writing and his friends kept talking to him, he'd never die. Foolish thought, but very comforting at Thanksgiving.
There is a passage in Sophie's Choice where the character, Sophie, has a glass of fine French wine, and she reflects, you know, when you live a good life like a saint, that must be what they make you drink in paradise. And we started by saying that, you know, we were raising a toast, a Thanksgiving toast to William Styron. I'm imagining he is toasting now.
I imagine he is, too. I'm sure he's up there in a cloud looking down and toasting us and laughing and saying, oh, it's another morning, excellent and fair. And he's free of pain. We hated to let him go, but he was in much pain. And we're thankful that his spirit is around, opening and closing doors we don't expect and flying down with the birds to seize a piece of our lives.
Rose Styron, a wife of the late author William Styron. Rose, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Well, thank you, Robin. It's the first time I've talked about Bill, and I'm really glad you made me do it.
Thank you. Coming up, a son of Plymouth, Massachusetts, imagines the pilgrims who lived there before him. Much more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now?
Here and Now.
It's getting dark now in Plymouth. Their cider is gone. Near the cinders, men kneel in conference with Squanto and wonder what God has in store for them beyond this plentiful year. A bundle of arrows wrapped in a snakeskin. Savage disease. A killing frost that would require bringing the goats into their kitchens. Thanks be to God for the salted cod in our storehouse, victuals and beer, jars of berries picked from the marshes. Thanks be to God for these racks of deer, the blessed gift of Massasoit, our friend.
That's David Roderick reading the closing stanza from his poem Thanksgiving 1621 from his wonderful first book, Blue Colonial. The poems reimagine his hometown, Plymouth, Massachusetts, through the stories of the English colonists who settled there in 1620 and the Native Americans who already called that land their home. Into that narrative, David weaves his own memories. The Blue Colonial is both the one he grew up in and the beset colonists, as described by Robert Pinsky in his introduction. And poet David Roderick joins us with more. Welcome.
Thanks so much for having me, Robin.
Well, this is just such a lovely small work. It's a small volume. And you were just reading from Thanksgiving 1621, Squanto, the Patuxet Indian, who helped the pilgrims that first winter. It has an edge to it. Tell us what the tone is you were trying to get at.
Well, the tone, I think, in this poem is interesting to me because it's me just trying to imagine that place. And I think that's a moment in time for the colonists and probably for the Native Americans, too, where they're feeling pleased with themselves. They've survived the year. They have all this food in store. So, and then the tone, I think, sort of shifts at that mm-hmm. moment that I just read when I said it's getting dark now in Plymouth. And that's because of a very harsh winter is on its way.
Right. Prior to that, you have the women. And you have to imagine, what did the women, for instance, think of, you know, Massasoit with the feathers in his hair, his
sure.
painted thighs, the blue wisp from his pipe. Imagine them, you know, walking around with their baskets of food, trying to sneak a peek at him.
Exactly. Right. I imagine he would have been quite a sight to behold.
Well, and another poem which we want to look at is the Plymouth poem. It's called The Good News from Plymouth.
Sure.
Can you just read the first stanza? It's called The Landing, which says a little bit about that duality, you know, both the hope and the promise, but, you know, the scariness that might be ahead.
I'd be happy to read it. 1. Landing. The right foot slips on a rock, but the left foot plants into sand. First steps of an infant colony near a rack line of driftwood and kelp. 2 shallops keel over the tide, strangers and saints locking elbows in the froth. An ocean's fatigue. A line of goodwives climbing the dune's spine. They have baskets or children in their arms, iron pots, spools. They walk toward hornpout and otter fat, toward the gleam of a minted name. But above them the sky is spoiled cream, clabber from the bottom of a pail.
Spoiled cream. Tell us about you, David. As you were growing up in Plymouth, and there's much about that in this as mm-hmm. well, You must have known the story from when you were a child. How much did you spend trying to imagine what it must have looked like?
I don't think I imagined it much because it's sort of packaged into this neat myth for us to sort of enjoy, I think. It's a nice story on the surface.
Did you go down and look at the rock,
as
everyone else has?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I mean, every year we had field trips to go onto the Mayflower and to see the rock and whatnot. So I think when you're a child and you're inundated with it and you're surrounded it, that's really your whole world, or at least it was for me at the time. You don't really question it. And when I became much older and was an adult and started to kind of write about this material, it really crept up on me, and I realized that I had bought into the myth, and I was just curious about what was beneath that myth. So the book for me as an adult is kind of a quest to get back to a childlike way of looking at the world, to kind of peer at things more closely, whether it's these historical stories or whether it's nature, things that I think I took for granted and maybe a lot of us take for granted.
You know, it's funny because you say that you, as a small child, you hadn't really thought that much about this because we all were handed the myth and we just took it in. But in the poem Blue Colonial, about that colonial suburban house you grew up in the woods around it, I do picture you just sort of trying to, as I feel a lot of American kids do. I mean, I can remember putting my face in wet dirt and trying to see if I could smell Indians, you know, when I was really...
Or looking for arrowheads. I remember doing that
arrowheads.
As a child.
You did seem to have some of that.
I think so. And part of this project for me was, I think I'd forgotten that I had that experience as a child. And in that particular poem that you're referring to, Blue Cone, I'm really trying to reach back to that experience and remember it as clearly as I can.
Hmm. You don't live in Plymouth now.
No.
You're down in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. How would you say of Plymouth now? I mean, some New Englanders feel as, you know, almost the ghost of Plymouth is still there, but just, you know, sort of paved over.
Sure. Well, it's like every other suburban town in this country, I think. It's undergoing change as we speak. New developments are going in, strip malls. And a lot of it has changed, but I think to some degree I'm lamenting that a little bit in this book. But really, this is the story of every sort of smaller town that changes, and I'm trying not to judge whether or not that's good or bad. It's just sort of a fact of life, I guess.
Well, it's a story too about the ghosts,
yes,
the Indians,
sure,
the colonists,
right? I mean, we just keep it's layer over layer over layer, and. Of history and change and one of the fun parts of this book was trying to reach through all of those layers and go back to sort of an original clean slate and that first contact back in 1620.
This is David Roderick. His first book of poetry is called Blue Colonial. It won the 9th Annual American Poetry Review Honickman First Book Prize. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And I'd love it if you could leave us on this day in particular with the poem Thanksgiving.
Sure, I'd be happy to. Thanksgiving. For the heron that rousts the swamp, thank you, and for spiders shocked into gradual sleep. The rakes near the fence remind me to thank you for balm. Thank you for ducks that tuck patterns into various codes, because in the absence of sunlight, the yard spades to a saturate brown. Sometimes a song curls back down my throat. Sometimes gourds rot, or frail cocoons get torn from the reeds. I hunt for paralyzed stances and nests out here where the air is chilled with sly surprise. Before the Billington crusts with frost, I gather river stones blotched with crystals. Thank you for showing me how things grip inward, coral frogs, sap that slows in its thermal sleeves. No easy transitions, just recurring motifs, warped wands that blend the species of wind. When oaks molt their crowns, their colors spill to my shoulders. Sometimes egg sacs burr the fur of animals and fall into patchwork light. Most of us hunker down for a while and sleep, but some move around and listen for the hum of a secondary life. I can hear it today, even back in my garage, where all the sills are filled with flies.
Poet David Roderick. Well, coming up, we're going to listen once again to the snow geese migration in Vermont. You're listening to Here and Now. The world we just heard David Roderick imagine in his poetry comes to life at the Plymouth Plantation. Now, it's a living museum built just miles from the original Pilgrim settlement and on the home site of the Wampanoag Native Americans. Visitors can talk to 17th century pilgrims portrayed by interpreters who never break character. They can also meet modern Wampanoag Indians who share their long history. Well, today, food historian Kathleen Curtin takes us on a tour of Plymouth Plantation to see what's on the menu for this Thanksgiving.
This is our recreation of the 1627 English village, and it's probably about one-third the size of the real community back in 1627. And 1627 is the year that we portray, which is about 6 years after that first harvest celebration. It's a perfectly good pilgrim day with the gray ocean, blue-gray, and the clouds, and a little overcast, a little chill in the air, which we haven't had so far this year. So this actually feels just right for us. And we'll take a look in a couple of houses and see what's going on. Let me see if we've got a fire going here.
We've got a hen roasting and catching the drippings of it, frying up some leeks with that. Going to be making fritters as well, so it's a very fat time of the year for us, very bountiful in this place. The hen is to a spit, and inside of the belly we have put bread, a little bit of butter, and parsley. And so it will be turning on the spit for about an hour, hour and a half.
I favour a goose filled with chestnuts, which are also available this time of year, to gather the chestnuts up to put them in a goose. I might stew some ducks up as well. There'd be more than one sort of thing on the table, perhaps some venison to make into a pasty, to put into a sort of a pie.
I think one of the misunderstandings about food in the past is that it lacked flavor. Certainly something like a goose or a duck or a turkey has an intrinsic flavor and a deliciousness that a lot of our modern food doesn't. Our modern turkeys, I think, are bland. A wild turkey has a lot more flavor. It really depends on what you're used to. The English were also flavoring their sauces with spices, with pepper, with vinegar, with onions, perhaps with garlic. The rougher country sorts may have used garlic. Daintier people wouldn't have liked it.
This is a pottage of cabbages, so cabbages stewed up with a little broth and then set with a little oil on top of them. My mother would always call that serving them in the Spanish fashion, for the oil doth come from Spain.
Cabbage is a windy meat, and belching and farting were not things that people held back then, which are, I think would be pretty shocking to some of our modern diners who are of more delicate nature.
Cabbage is a countryman's meat. There's nothing dainty about a cabbage. My mother could not serve cabbages to everyone, for she said I might as well give them a bagpipes or a bellows, for they are just a little too windy.
When visitors come to the 1627 English village on Thanksgiving Day, it's a day like any other because our modern American holiday didn't happen in 1621. They actually celebrated that first harvest celebration probably in October, not November. Our holiday ends up at the end of November due to some other factors. So it's just an ordinary day with lots of people. And of course, we often put some turkeys and ducks down here as well so people can get their photo opportunities. That's pretty important, too. And a picture taken with a pilgrim.
Edward Winslow is my name. That spring we had an alliance signed with a man named Usamequin, or Massasoit, who's a king in this countryside here, an Indian man. And he came to the town with, I say, probably 90 of his men. And there being some that had spent the summer with us and planted with us that year, the king, he had sent a couple dozen of his men out for shooting deer, and they bestowed 5 of them upon our town. Fresh venison, I mean, back home in England, it's a meat I never really had. It's really the king's meat. And to eat such a meat is quite prosperous and quite plentiful, and very thankful in truth.
Our trip to Plymouth Plantation was produced by Here and Now's Kevin Sullivan. Well, stay right there. Our annual visit to the snow geese is next, Here and Now. just here and now. Thanksgiving is a time of trundling off to visit the relatives or to remember past visits. Some of you might remember a pilgrimage we made to Vermont to see the annual migration of the snow geese with my uncle Lachlan McLaughlin Field. He, like the migrating geese, was slowly leaving us at that time. He was 88, had just begun a bout with Alzheimer's, and would pass away just before Thanksgiving of 2004 at the age of 91. Well, people always ask me about my Uncle Locke, so here again, the story of the trip I'm so thankful I took. The snow geese, thousands of them, touched down every fall at a refuge called Dead Creek. My Uncle Locke had taken me there once to see the brown Canadian geese, but I wanted to see the snows. My cousin Peggy kept writing this fall, telling me that the snows had arrived. Finally, I got the subtext of her postcards. The leaves were falling. The snow geese would soon be leaving. And at 88, it's not like my uncle was going to wait around forever either. So up to Vermont we went.
Uncle Locke?
Yo!
Hi!
Hey, yo!
We should go see the geese while we can.
Yeah. Okay, I'll go with you.
My uncle, Lachlan McLaughlin Field, looms large in my branch of the family. We were from the suburbs of New York. He collected arrowheads and with his son carved duck decoys. He and my late Aunt Martha spent years in the war, then came to Middlebury where he taught high school art. To us, he was General Patton meets Norman Rockwell.
I can't drive the car anymore. I haven't been out of this. I haven't seen it. You're the first person I've seen in this house in 2 weeks.
No.
That's true.
Well, hardly. It's just that at 88, Uncle Locke recently had to give up cross-country skiing. He's not painting as much.
Sit around. Vegetate.
Not today. We're going to geese.
Pro. What, in case someone steals it?
When was the last time you heard an alarm up here?
I got it.
So, off to Dead Creek, about a 20-minute drive from Middlebury. And on the way, we would do what relatives do this time of year, whether convening to go see a bird or to eat one. We just talked.
So, have you been following all the news? You know, all the fighting in Afghanistan and...
Yeah, well, I'm going to tell you something. At my age, all I can remember is fighting. It's been going on for years. Slow down, because you're going to go across the traffic that goes that way. You go straight.
Didn't you fight in the Battle of the Bulge?
Well, yeah, me and several hundreds of thousands of other people.
Yeah, I didn't think you were there by yourself.
Yeah, all alone, I held them up. Yeah, that was sort of cold weather. A lot of snow.
Tell me about Dead Creek. I've been trying to explain it, that it's sort of a resting place where the migratory birds?
Yeah, it's right on the big flyway from north to south. So they flock in there. I've seen geese there you wouldn't believe, but no guarantee this time that they're there. See, the weather's getting colder and they are going to hang around.
I know.
They go through sometimes in by the thousands. I saw one day I walked out the backyard. And snow geese are going by. Yeah. They were low, very, very, very low, and they're way back of the house. They were flying single file. And I bet you the line of them was probably 3 football field length.
Really?
Yeah. So I got big. I watched this big chain going just up over the top of the trees, down and down and down. Never seen it since.
Huh.
Sometimes you can hear them coming. All honking away. Sound exactly like that, if you want to know.
They do. Okay, Uncle Locke, you just saw a sign, Dead Creek Wildlife Management. And the good news is I see some cars up ahead. I see.
See? A lot of times the geese get out in there. See?
Okay. Right.
There they go. See them?
Yep. All right, now
look at the cars here.
I know.
Well, that means a lot of geese. Look at them out there. See them?
Yep. Let's go up there. Oh, look, there's geese.
At Dead Creek, we met up with my cousins and Brian Pfeiffer, a member of the Vermont Audubon Society, who runs several bird tours.
We're seeing regularly Ross's goose. It's a small version of a snow goose. And people think that we're nuts, you know, because we come out here and we look for one Ross's goose. But it's also...
Name that thing again.
Ross's, R-O-S-S.
Ross's.
R-O-S-S apostrophe S.
Yeah, okay.
Ross's
goose.
Huh? Yeah. Small. They're out here.
Yeah, I want to see one now.
Yeah,
see,
so do I.
Yeah.
Hey, but look, I'm looking up there. I'm way up, much higher than the others we've seen. There's a V forming. Are they leaving?
Also, if you look right over the parking lot here, is a bird that's hovering. That's a red-tailed hawk hovering. But yes, those birds are leaving. You notice the V formation?
Yeah.
You see how one arm of the V is longer than the other?
Yeah.
They've actually figured out why that is. The longer arm has more geese in it.
Oh my gosh! Hundreds, thousands of them! Uncle Locke, look! Thousands!
Brown!
Yeah.
Something. Here they come.
Wow, this is the best way to look at him.
I will never forget the look on my uncle's face. He'd put on my cousin's cape because of the cold, and when the birds rose up, probably because of that hawk, so did he. It was as if the ground where the snow geese were had been covered with snow, and then someone scooped it all up and threw it in the air like confetti.
One great fall experience. And you had it. I mean, when they all flew over your heads, you know, I mean, that's just, I live for that every fall.
But I saw the snow geese one time going by down through Cornwall.
Yeah.
Looked out back, and it was nothing but a thin white line.
Yes.
As far as you could see, and tree height. As far south as you see.
Okay. We're getting frozen.
That's right.
What'd you think?
Think about what?
The geese.
Oh, pretty nice. Yeah, I've seen millions of them, you know.
I know you have. But I saw the look on your face when that group lifted up.
Oh, it's tremendous, isn't it?
Yeah.
With weather like this, they'll be taken off out of here. They'll be gone. When they go, it's like turning the light off. They're gone.
Yeah. Okay. When you want to get something to eat?
You want to get something to eat?
Yeah.
Not particularly. Why, you?
Yes, I do.
A return visit to the snow geese of Vermont with my late uncle, Lachlan McLachlan Field, who passed away in 2004 at the age of 91. I think of him often, especially when I see a line of geese stretched across the sky.
A thin white line, as far as you can see, and tree height. Just one long column of them. When they go, it's like click, turning the light off. They're gone.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Have a wonderful Thanksgiving, and please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us.